It's my pleasure to introduce today's honors convocation speaker. Professor Robert Tisdale is the current holder of the Marjorie Crabb Garbush Professor of English and the Liberal Arts. I remember probably a decade ago a conversation I had with Professor Deborah Appleman in the hallways of Willis. We were discussing a problematic and thorny situation, trying to figure a way of resolution. In a particularly frustrating moment, Deborah turned to me and said, "Well, we need to ask ourselves, what would Bob Tisdale do?" Besides the oddity of Professor Appleman presaging the WWJD movement, I remember responding, "Exactly. The reasoned, thoughtful, fair, and quintessentially intelligent way that Professor Tisdale has lived his life and that has been a hallmark of his career is what has made him the mentor, whether he knows it or not, to most of the faculty sitting behind me. I speak from personal experience when I say that among the most influential opportunities I had in my early years on the faculty at Carleton was working under Professor Tisdale's guidance on the Faculty Affairs Committee. Professor Tisdale was a product of the Ivy League, BA from Princeton, PhD from Yale in English Literature, early college teaching stint at Dartmouth. But he made it through that gauntlet, not nearly as damaged as we might expect. He arrived at Carleton in 1966 with an expertise in American literature and a commitment to teaching. After 40 years, that commitment still burns. The energy he has brought to his classes is fueled by his students, who in his own words are incredibly civil, thoughtful, and curious, and they actually do the reading. His courses include the basics, for example, Introduction to Modern Literature, to the more edgy American Indian literature, a course taught this past winter, to Growing Up Ironic and Learning to Curse. No wonder students do the reading. His scholarship has been a wonderful mix of critical analysis and creative production. His poetry has appeared in many places, but two collections worth noting are A Yard of Twine and I'm a Stranger Here Myself, connecting intellect with aesthetics in personal ways makes his work particularly effective and particularly fitting for Carleton. Even thinking about how to summarize Professor Tisdale's service to the college was exhausting. I will not try. I will, however, note that one, he has been a leader in developing one of the nation's finest English departments, one that mirrors both his devotion to teaching and his success in the classroom. Two, his generous support for American studies has helped anchor that program within the Carleton curriculum and help make it, too, a national leader. Three, he has been associate dean and acting dean of the college at a difficult point of transition in the college history, reflecting the degree of respect he has earned from the faculty that I noted above. Four, his consistent and tireless commitment to increasing the diversity of the Carleton community has been a key reason why this room looks so different than it would have looked without Bob's vision. Most of you know that Professor Tisdale was Carleton's first posse faculty mentor. And five, when President O'Dean notes that the Carleton community prizes a sense of humor above nearly all else, he is thinking directly of Bob Tisdale. His sharp and clever wit is the envy of every faculty member. There is, of course, so much more that could be said, but I suspect that much of it will be evidenced in his address to us today. It is my personal honor to introduce Professor Robert Tisdale, whose talk
That introduction was outrageously generous. Thank you. President O'Dean, deans, newly minted and veteran deans alike, brilliant, hardworking, staff, and faculty. Honored students, friends, I know that this is a celebration, so I shouldn't complain, but I'm a kvetcher. Talk about a gauntlet. These last few days have closely resembled a notorious Carlton job interview. Questions about what my scholarly or creative plans are, where my wife and I will live in retirement, then a poetry reading, this convo talk, and a dinner tonight with the English department, where after plying me with food and wine, they are going to interrogate my career. And when I mentioned this to my wife, Dagmar, she said, "So if you don't measure up, they're going to fire you?" I was not reassured. When I began to think about this talk, I decided to dedicate it to some who have helped sustain me through my career at Carleton, the men I fish with. We cast and retrieve and eschew live bait. When we devote ourselves to cleaning the banks and banks of a river or the bottom of a lake, we often catch a few fish. But we always return with food for our brains and spirits. They are this peculiar group of fishing faculty, to use a careful Minnesota term, interesting. I'll give you only a few snapshots. There is the chemist, who on our trip north scarfs down bacon cheeseburgers with double fries and then spends a week lecturing us about the molecular structure of harmful food additives and the cardiac virtues of Pinot Noir. There is a composer so meticulous in his task as dishwasher, he always washes the dishes, that he cleans the Brillo before he uses it on the pots. And there is an economist, the spouse of a well-known Carleton French professor, even better known today, French professor, who compulsively fishes with artificial frogs. I could go on, but friends warned me about libel and reminded me that this is a solemn occasion and that I should be serious. So I chose for this afternoon to talk about images of darkness. Why this topic? To a remarkable extent, light and darkness can define the history, hopes, and fears of this country. And because distinctively American literature matured during the Romantic period from 1800 to 1850, the Romantic Revolution in imagery gave to major American literary works a special provocativeness, implications and ironies concerning darkness that are both entertaining and heretical. Consequently, images of darkness that we encounter in our literature often convey prophetic insight into crucial aspects of our culture. And by prophecy, I don't refer to predictions about the future, but rather insight into the spiritual health of a culture. Although not an American writer, the Irish poet and Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney uses darkness in a way that can speak for many American writers. I'll start with a line from which I take the title of this talk, the first line of Heaney's poem, The Forge. All I know is a door into the dark. Any poet would kill to have written that line. In this sonnet, Heaney gives us an image of the forge, the craftsman with horny hands beating out real iron in the center of his smithy. There's a fire in the forge, which in previous eras could have suggested the demonic or the primitive, but here it has quite another resonance. The smith's anvil is compared to an altar and his work as shaping and musical. Plainly, Heaney encourages us to see the smith at his anvil as an image of the artist, In spite of the seemingly vast distance between iron and words, hammer and pen, fire and imagination. I'll read the poem. All I know is a door into the dark. Outside, old axles and iron hoops rusting. Inside, the hammered anvil's short-pitched ring. The unpredictable fantail of sparks or hiss when a new shoe toughens in water. The anvil must be somewhere in the center, horned as a unicorn, at one end square, set there immovable, an altar where he expends himself in shape and music. Sometimes, leather-aproned, hairs in his nose, he leans out on the jam, recalls a clatter of hooves where traffic is now flashing in rows. Then grunts and goes in with a slam and a flick to beat real iron out to work the bellows. When Heaney speaks of the dark, he speaks to the source of his truths and music, not to the bright and lightning heavens, but to the physical, the past, the emotions, and the unconscious. He implies that we need to understand what darkness can do for us. Undoubtedly, in our daily lives, we would prefer light to darkness, but literature enters the dark in order to enlighten us. Images or symbols of darkness, especially in a carefully drawn historical setting, are enlightening to explore because so often they locate the source of our finest humanity, or they are subversive of blind convention, repressive order, and inhumane institutions. The scholar Frank Kermode, among others, remarked that the figurative language of Romanticism and the literary eras that followed it are marked by a reversal of the earlier ages' identification of goodness with heaven and light. Darkness and inwardness become the sites of genuine spirit. The Romantic period's revolution in worldview, sensibility, and idiom stem in large part from the need of its writers to find images for that age of revolution and the evolution of social and political democracy. Images to embody new conceptions of heroism, nobility, moral goodness, and spiritual beauty. The challenge of finding new imagery for new worldviews was there, and the strongest writers responded. There is, for example, Hester Prynne, Hawthorne's publicly shamed heroine, whose scarlet letter A for adultery comes first to mean artist and then finally angel. One would have expected an artist or angel to be associated with the light of heaven rather than with the darkness of sin. Hawthorne was saying something about the quality of Christianity in his time, I think. Twain's heroes in The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn are the dirty and ragged son of the town drunk and an unlettered escaped slave. Neither is particularly learned or enlightened, except where the wisdom of the heart is concerned. The hero of Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage runs from his first battle and regains his courage after experiencing intense shame. Hemingway's protagonist in The Sun Also Rises is an impotent journalist. His hero in A Farewell to Arms is a deserter. Many American protagonists are anti-heroes who learn or show us wisdom from their darker experiences rather than from the bright success of shining heroism. One image that has a profound grasp on my imagination is from the conclusion of Melville's Moby Dick. After Captain Ahab's whaling ship, the Pequod, has sunk, the only survivor is Ishmael, the book's narrator, who is buoyed up on the deep by a coffin, an image that would ordinarily evoke death rather than life. Melville's Christian readers are familiar with the sacrificial death that redeems, and Melville's particular image may allude to Christianity, but if so, it is with a marked irony and a dark hue. Here's the context. Very ill and anticipating his own death, the harpooner Queequeg has had a wooden coffin made by the ship's carpenter. When he recovers from his illness, he carefully inscribes the coffin with the figures or hieroglyphics that are tattooed on his own body. And that way, the coffin becomes a surrogate for Queequeg's body. So later, it is as if Queequeg's corpse preserves Ishmael from death. The full significance of this is not understood unless the reader remembers that Queequeg, the allegedly cannibalistic savage of whom Ishmael had first been so afraid, turns out to be the least violent and most loving, collegial, and civilized member of the entire crew. They had shared a bed, a common practice in crowded inns of the 19th century. And as a result of observing Queequeg's equanimity and serenity in a strange American seaport, a place utterly alien to Queequeg, Ishmael says, "I began to be sensible of strange feeling. I felt a melting in me. No more my splintered heart and maddened hand were turned against the wolfish world. This soothing savage had redeemed it." Returning to the later image of Ishmael clinging to Queequeg's coffin at the end of the book, out in the midst of the vast Pacific, one sees a classic returning image in American literature, an image with a dark, rather subversive meaning. An allegedly pagan savage, a man of color, has in fact saved the threatened white man. And this time, clearly, the redemption from the depths concerns most intimately the body, as the example of Queequeg's civilization, magnanimity, and serenity has already redeemed and enlightened Ishmael's soul. Another classic that you'd think would need no further commentary is Twain's Huckleberry Finn. Here the darkness that Twain explores is self-righteous slaveholding Christianity and the related hypocrisies of civilization, which Huck spells with an S, S-I-V-I-L, so forth. That is what Huck flees, civilization with an S. And in so doing, he finds himself in league with Jim, an escaped slave. Ernest Hemingway claimed that all American literature comes out of Huckleberry Finn, but he also said that you must stop reading after Jim is stolen from Huck, and many people do, I think. That is precisely where some of the scariest darkness of the book manifests itself, however. Twain's savage irony is often lost on readers who have been fatigued by the burlesque slapstick of the last chapters. But it is there that we see the dark depths to which even children can sink. In the conclusion of the book, Huck passes himself off as Tom, thereby losing the freedom he enjoyed on the raft and identifying himself with the allegedly enlightened white civilization with an S that he fled. Soon, Tom appears, identifying himself as the insufferable Sid. Showing his true colors, he exclaims how wonderful it would have been to keep Jim in bondage until they all grew old together and then pass Jim on to their children to continue this game of freeing a free African American. No wonder Twain wants Huck to light out for Indian territory. Literature may have become more complicated since World War I, but images of nourishing darkness contrasted with evil brightness persist. I'm going to read a poem by James Wright written at the end of the 1950s. This poem really anticipates the Vietnam War and later American adventures. The poem is Eisenhower's Visit to Franco, 1959. And the poem's voice is that of American triumphalism, the kind of thinking and feeling that Wright wants us to understand as arrogant and dangerous to humanity and to us. The poem is prefaced with an epigraph from Unamuno: "We die of cold and not of darkness." The American hero must triumph over the forces of darkness. He has flown through the very light of heaven and come down in the slow dusk of Spain. Franco stands in a shining circle of police, his arms open in welcome. He promises all dark things will be hunted down. State police yawn in the prisons. Antonio Machado follows the moon down a road of white dust to a cave of silent children under the Pyrenees. Wine darkens in stone jars in villages. Wine sleeps in the mouths of old men. It is a dark red color. Smiles glitter in Madrid. Eisenhower has touched hands with Franco, embracing in a glare of photographers. Clean new bombers from America muffle their engines and glide down now. Their wings shine in the searchlights of bare fields in Spain. Wright's poem amasses images of light, the light of heaven, the shining circle of police, the glittering smiles of politicians, generals, the glare of photographers, and the cleanliness of those bombers' wings caught in the searchlights. Then his poem reverses the conventional moral or spiritual values of light and darkness in order to make the point that fascism may seem rational and powerful. It was certainly anti-communist. But in Spain and other repressive regimes, it has infinitely less moral claim than do the irrationality of darkness of children, wine, old men, and even some inmates of prisons. I'll end by discussing the complex central image from the novel that has had the strongest influence on my private and public life, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, which I read when it was first published in 1952. Ellison's image of a man who is invisible to others and occasionally to himself is striking because it suggests power. The power to act unseen, as if in darkness, as is the case in Tomming, or playing to the stereotype in order to manipulate others. It also suggests powerlessness, being in the dark, because if others do not see you, you soon come to doubt your worthiness, if not your own existence. As Ellison develops the image of invisibility, he gradually suggests an idea that he finally puts in the mouth of one of the protagonist's college teachers. In a comment on James Joyce's novel, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, this professor, Professor Wooldridge, claims that Joyce's protagonist has mistaken the problem. The hero, Stephen Dedalus, says he wants to create, this young Irishman who's fed up with Ireland, he wants to create the uncreated conscience of his race. Wooldridge, however, speaking from his own point of view, says that what the post-colonial subject, and in this case the African-American in 1952, needs to do is to create the uncreated features of his face. In other words, he needs to investigate the dark areas of his life, his past, his fears, the truths he has evaded, in order to become visible, in order to gain an identity. That's one of the most powerful images I know. It speaks to central aspects of the human condition, and to me, it says that in order to be visible in the world, you must forsake the blindness of conformity, stop acting under the radar, speak and act with confidence, even when you fear others may not see or hear you, and as you strive to act like a free man or woman, create the features of your face. Through this image, Ellison opens a door into the darkness of racism, segregation, and all objectifications of human beings to the point where they lose individuality, freedom, and even their own humanity. At that time, he opened a door for me, and I have been learning and teaching about images of darkness ever since. Among many other things, darkness stands for what we do not know. It is a source of mystery and power. It attracts the imagination of psychologists and physicists, historians and chemists, philosophers, artists, musicians. So I encourage you, each in your own way, to open that door into the dark. You will show that you have the tools and skills to find the treasures there. You have the will and energy to share your warmth and the good sense not to mistake glittering whiteness or brightness for truth. Thank you very much.